Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We continue in our next class in the Sefer Da Es Atzmecha, getting to know yourself. We are, ending chapter 3 in the Hebrew book that nobody has right now, but people listening on tape might be listening. Page Tzadi Vav at the bottom. In the English, we're on page 53. Okay, 53. But what I'm going to do, for you, it says chapter 2. And I don't want to explain why in the Hebrew it's chapter 3 and in English it's chapter 2, only to confuse people. We have one more little section to do. But there's always a new person who comes from time to time. I don't want them to feel lost. So what we're going to do, and I've thought it through, so don't think I'm crazy. We're going to go forward a couple pages to the beginning of chapter 4. Why would I do that? Well, you'll see on page 56 in English, he gives you a little recap of the first two chapters. So for those that aren't here, you get a little review, and it really is a nice little review. And then we'll go back and do that last section of the chapter before, and then we'll go forward. That way, no one will feel like they're out in the middle of the ocean like that, and that we should be good on that, all right? So again, in the English, it'll be on page 56, and in the Hebrew, it's page Kuf, which will start an amazingly exciting chapter that will be starting in about 15 to 20 minutes. But first we'll get this little overview in. Okay, you with me, guys? Page 56 in the English and page Kuf in the Hebrew. So he says, Tamtzis HaPrakim HaKodmin, just an overview of what the first few chapters have discussed. So he says, HaMetzius HaMiti Shal HaAdam, the true reality of a person is a neshama shemelubash aleh haguf, a soul that is enclosed with the garment of a body. That is the true reality of a person. Now, the problem is, people identify the reverse, that we are really a body that happens to also have a soul, which is an incorrect definition of who we are. So, kidei la'akar sazi'u ha'rogel shodem izas asu gaguf shebetocha neshama, in order to uproot this identification that most people customarily identify with themselves as a body that has a soul within them. A person has to pass through the three mystical stages of Hachna, Havdola, Vahamtaka, which is, again, this subjugation, separation, and sweetening, which we discussed how you've got to smash and separate the different feelings that you have and identify them in different corners. And then only later will you bring them back together and sweeten them. So, as we talked about a lot the last few weeks. Haderach haretzuya b'avoda, the best way to do this is shiluv shel ha'achno im avdola, to do the subjugation and the separation at the same time. And how? Al yidei hadas, or using one's das, the capacity to discern between what is real and what is not. Shikoach avdol, that is the power of separation, lahavdil, bein tov l'ra, u'gam bein tov l'tov, to separate between good and evil, and even between good and good, which will bring you, yagil achna, which will bring you to this subjugation. In other words, to separate between who I am and who I am not, and what I do that is out of character for me, and what I do that is in character for me. To separate these things so we don't have false identities of who we are. So now, ba'odim yeshum shlosha chalokim, a person has three parts to his reality, machshavas hargoshes umaisim, thoughts, feelings, and actions. Vavodas havdolat shrich liyasus begim uchalokim elu. And a person's service of separation needs a person to be engaged in these three parts. I think it's getting warm in this room. Do you agree? Yeah. So if you give me 30 seconds, I'll make this place cool. Okay?
Sure.
Just give me 30 seconds. So not only have to be the rabbi, you have to be the janitor. It's very important. Very important to make the place cool. Okay, so we have three avenues within ourselves that we've got to separate and understand. Our thoughts, our feelings, and our actions. This service of separation needs to be working in these three areas. The area of activity, and actions, mischalak l'shtayim is divided into two parts. Ma'isim she'en lo shayuchas klal la'odom, v'odom m'shayach osam alav. Actions that really have nothing connected to the person at all, but the person thinks they do. Beis, ma'asim shodom achein also, actions that a person does do. V'afal became son of olav l'das, asakvul hadak. Person has to know the boundaries in what you do. Elu told us be'emes shayochimetz. I love certain things that come out of him that are really appropriate and they're coming from who you really are. Ve'elu told us avshenasi machmasam in eshayochim be'emes lepulos, or things that come out of him that really are not coming from who he really is, but the part of him that's not him, which is the body and not the soul. Amnam, however, afilu ma'ase shorem asa b'pol, even something that person actually does, imamasa who told, if it's a good thing, olav lezaso so es atzmiuso, he should identify that with his reality. Vimushlili, and if it's negative, olav lezaso nasa imakoch echitzonish, he should identify that that's with the external force of him, kochas aguf, the forces of the body, vloim koch hapnimi shvo, and not with the inner force, that's him, haneshama, the soul. And the next chapter is going to deal with feelings. So now, that was the recap. So now we're going to backtrack two pages and give the last example of how this is a very important thing to identify with. So now I'll go back to page 53 and we'll give one last, we'll give a number of examples. We'll give one last one on page Sadivav. The difference between identifying yourself as a soul that has a body over it, or identifying yourself as a body that has a soul. There's a world of difference between. So let's see what he says. You have to bear with me. I have a little cold sore on my tongue. That's why I'm sounding a little bit off. So now, he says, "At kama chamor matzava shalom shayich eschoshonosav le'etzam ani shalo nume mamashal haba." To understand how very terrible is the situation of a person who attributes his faults to his essence, we will learn from the following parable. Again, I will paraphrase and not read so much of the Hebrew just to be able to move ahead, and it should be similar to what you have in the English. First, he says, we all have, you know, many of us have or had parents. And some of us have merited to have grandmothers and grandfathers. But usually what happens when people pass on, usually the parents pass on first before the children. The parents get old. They live in this, remember, he's from Eretz Yisrael. So he says, and parents will live in a house for 50 years and they don't make repairs on the house. So then what happens is, you know, one day the parents die. And what happens after the shiva, the children now have to deal with the estate. They have to deal with the property. And the children are sitting around after the shiva. So one of them says, you know, this property's been neglected. Look what's going on over here. The plaster's starting to peel from the walls. The sink is lousy. The tiles are cracked. You know, it hasn't been touched in 50 years. You know what I think we should do? We should destroy the building. Right? And we'll sell the property as a parking lot. That's one son's opinion. The other son says, listen, I agree, you're right. The sink needs to get fixed and the plaster is peeling. But, you know, the difference between that and destroying a house, that's a big distance to go. I would suggest we hire a contractor and we figure out what improvements need to be made. And we'll put in, I don't know, $20,000 of improvements. And that should solve the problem. A building that's been around for 70 years does not need to be destroyed necessarily. The foundation's good. The walls are still fine. Costs a lot of money for that. So why should we knock it down? So this is his parable, obviously. But he says the parable is extreme, but the nimshal, how it relates to actual life, isn't it getting cooler already? Right? It's more comfortable? Good. It's easier to learn that way. So the how it relates to real life is precise. He says like this. If there are people who find, when they look inside themselves, they find certain deficiencies. A person looks himself and sees I got some few things wrong with me. They look at themselves and they label themselves as a negative person. You know, I got this fault, I got that fault, that. I'm a bad person. But if the person would sit and really dissect all his virtues and all his deficiencies, quite possibly, if he'd put it on the scale and start percentaging it, he'd say that, you know, 90% of me is really virtuous. And 10% has deficiency. You know? You know, figure, you know, people, you know, guy, let's say, goes to work every day, so he's conscientious, he's responsible. I mean, you don't have to hear too many people tell you that. You know, us, you know, boring people go to work every day, you know. You get up and you work on time and you're not cheating and you're trying to do an honest day's work. You know, and you're doing that for a good part of your day. That's very virtuous. You know, when's the last time you got complimented on that? When's the last time you complimented yourself on that? You know, and you go take care of the family, you take care of the kids, you take care of your spouse, you come out to learn, you daven three times a day, you're an honest person, you know. And if you really, and those are all the things that like nobody ever notices they're doing. You know, you cut the grass, you maintain that your house should look nice, that you're not an eyesore in the community, you know. And then, okay, you know, three times you yelled at your spouse. Okay, that's not good. That's not good. And, you know, a couple times you really overate. That's really bad. And, you know, and one time you, whatever, you know. But, and so if you really would be fair in analyzing it, that the bad, quote unquote bad, is about 10%. And by and large, we're not talking about really bad people. We're talking about like average normal people. And the good is about 90%, 90-10. But that's not how we act. We say from that 10% of failures that we have, we accept upon ourselves and we project upon ourselves a negative self-esteem. And we're going to add to what he says. Now I'm talking now. I just was paraphrasing until now. And really, the issue is the 10% of the faults are usually very open and very obvious. Either you recognize it or your friends are very quick to respond to them. And from this, a person is apt to draw negative conclusions that comes from which world? From the world of the body. That does not believe in the absolute unchangeable essence of what the person is, which is a pure and holy soul. And what do? You take that 10% and say that this is who I am. And this is why people react so negatively to criticism. Because they think the critic is out to destroy them. Because when they hear the critic saying, you've done this, and you are this, the person assimilates this is, you know, they're reflecting on what your body is doing. You're internalizing, that's what I am. And then you get a negative impression of yourself. And you don't want to have a negative impression of yourself. And then you think, that person is out to make my life miserable. Okay? So now, if the person, on the other hand, would identify with his neshama, with his soul, and he realizes that that 10% of negative is really attributed to what? To that body, which really isn't you. So guess what? You don't feel threatened by that criticism. It could be it needs correction, which is good, but there's no need to feel threatened. You know, I was having a discussion with somebody a while ago. And privately, I had discussed with this person some issues I had with them. I said, you know, you do certain things that are hurtful, and you know, I was privately, I mean, I said, I'm not meaning to hurt you, and I want to say this because I'm finding that you're hurting me. So the person, you know, got very defensive, and said, you know, it's not just all about me. I said, what do you mean? He says, you know, you have a lot of problems too. So I said, that's fine. Would you like to say what they are? I'd like to hear them. Because I'd like nothing to hear more than what faults I have, so I know I could improve them. That shut the guy down immediately. He says, well, I'll think about them. I said, that's good. And when you find out what they are, please, I beg you, please tell me what they are as soon as you know what they are, because I want to be better. I wasn't playing a game with him, but that was the truth. But you see, when I was talking to the person, and I was saying it in such a soft way, in such a non-confrontal way, and I just said, I just want you to know you do certain things, and they really hurt me a lot when you do what you're doing, and I just have to share that with you, and I think you might do that with other people too, it's possible. So the person could not handle that. But that's okay. That's okay. But, as a matter of fact, it's interesting. I spoke to him before I was learning this book. So this really helps me understand what his problem was. He's identifying himself more as the body. Okay. And I, hopefully, am identifying myself more as the soul. So that's why he's having all kinds of problems relating to that. And that's why people feel very threatened with criticisms. We don't want to hear criticisms. And in general, people are very fragile today. Very fragile. That's why this new word has come out, politically correct. Right? That's the greatest oxymoron in history. Because politics, by definition, means corruption and lies and incorrect. So to say something's politically correct really means to say we're giving you a corrupted version of reality. Okay? But anyway, but that's why people have to be politically correct. Because if you would call a spade, people couldn't handle it. And it's interesting that many times, you know, rabbis can say things without even him realizing it, and other people feel hurt by it because the rabbi wasn't fragile enough to say it, and he didn't even have anybody in mind. But, you know, I know that if, you know, once in 5 years I speak against gay issues, speak against it, always there's bound to be somebody who's furious with me, because they probably either have a gay friend or something, and how can I say that the Torah says it's an abomination or whatever? Like, they're just furious, and then other people tell the rabbi, you know, you're not being sensitive and you're hurting people. Now, number one, you know, the rabbi's not trying to not be sensitive, but he may not realize how sensitive people are. And more than that, the interesting reaction for many rabbis is that the rabbi then becomes defensive, saying, what do you mean I wasn't sensitive enough? So it goes in a full circle. The rabbi's trying to point out things. He's talking to their neshamas. He's thinking, but he has to realize that most people are listening with their bodies. And therefore, like all the great Hasidic rabbis have said countless times, we live in such a weak generation. We live in such a weak generation. You can't say boo to people. They can't take it. They mamish feel that you are attacking them, trying to destroy them, because when you're giving honest, and this is like general criticism, if the rabbi says, you know, people should be more like this, you know, so what do you mean? What do you mean? We're wonderful. You know, why did you make that line? Don't you know, there's a non-Jew in the audience and you're saying that Jews are different than non-Jews? How can you say such a thing? So they're getting all defensive, and when they say that the rabbi isn't being sensitive, the rabbi's getting defensive. What do you mean? What do you mean I'm not? So everybody's feeling criticized again. And that's what the tzaddik over here is saying, that, you know, you've got to be able to have the correct identification of who you are. If you are a soul, then it's the body is just the garment. Okay? The garment needs some replacement. I'm not threatened. Oh, there's a spot on your sweater. Oh, it's terrible. You know, Monica's not going to say, you know what? That was the biggest insult in my life. I'm taking it personally. I'm never coming back to the shul again. You know, you're going to say, thank you for telling me I have a spot on my sweater. I'll take care of it. And that's all. And that's the person who has a healthy understanding. But look, 90% of yourself is good. I think many people are suffering from depression now because they're focusing on that stupid 10%. You know, it's like, I hate to give examples, but I have to make it real, because I don't think I'm thinking of anybody. I just whatever pops into the head, that's what I say. Hashem is just telling me what to use as an example. You know, let's say men could have, men at midlife crisis can start to have bad self-esteem. You know, what if a guy, is beginning, you know, beginning to decline in his sexual potency. Okay, that'll keep everybody awake if I talk about that. So, he thinks he's a failure. He thinks a failure because everybody on TV isn't a failure. Right? Now, the fact that he's hard earning, caring father and husband, and he works every day, takes care of the house, and he helps people in the community and this and that, you know, So, you know, he's really a good guy. He's really a good guy. There's one little part of the body that's not working so well. And it really isn't like his fault. You get to a certain age and things change. And that's just the way it is. But if the guy identifies himself by that organ, which in the secular world many people do, so now his whole life is a failure. He is a failure. Now, and that's a terrible way to feel. He could say, oh, thank God I don't have this test to deal with anymore. You know, if you're a neshama, if you're a soul with a body, it's okay. So, you know, the old gray mare ain't what she used to be, but I ain't an old gray mare. I'm a neshama. And as a neshama, I'm a wonderful person. Okay. So that, you know, and obviously the same thing for women. You know, women get older and maybe they lose some of that youthful beauty. So if they always were looking at themselves as a body, then life is a disaster. You know, that's why the Botox industry is exploding and all these other things, because they can't live with a few wrinkles and a few this and a few that. Even though you're basically, you're a wonderful person, you're a sweet, loving mother, you're a caring friend, you're a beautiful human being. So you're looking a little bit like a prune, like, you know, it's not so terrible. Because that's not you. It's not you. The jacket's getting a little, you know. But your whole self-esteem is based on how I look. So, and now you have a very negative attitude. Now this can be that. It could be, let's say you have one terrible characteristic flaw. You have a terrible temper. Okay, that's bad. There's no question it's bad. But it doesn't mean you're bad. Doesn't mean you're bad. And that's so critical for us to realize. Even people suffer from addictions. Doesn't mean that they're bad. It means the body's getting into some trouble. The garment is getting in trouble. But you have a pure holy neshama inside of you. And you generally are doing good things. Now you're still responsible for what the body does. You have to try to make corrections. But you're not going to feel so threatened. Okay. So now he continues. But a healthy person, Adam Shehu Bari, we're near the bottom of page 53, Binav Shocho Shev Kach, person who's healthy in his soul, he thinks like this. He says, I have faults, but I have many virtues. He says, with these virtues, I should make use of them and I should sharpen them and develop them further. I should focus on my virtues and how can I use them and expand them in more areas in my life. And indeed, the faults I have to repair. But this whole general view of himself, of the I, is not like a person who's missing meaning in life. But the opposite, he finds himself within an inner process of building himself up. And this is, he's touching on, although he's not talking directly, but a very important concept in Judaism called Cheshbon HaNefesh. Cheshbon HaNefesh literally means an accounting for the soul. And what was the term I wanted to give it? It's a, I would call it spiritual forensic accounting. Okay, you know what forensic accountants are, right? Right? When the guy says my business, when he's in a divorce and he tells, you know, he claims he's only making $30,000, I can't pay much support to my ex. Right? But then the forensic accountant say, that's interesting, how come you have a $600,000 gas bill in your company? It doesn't quite add up that you're only making $30,000, right? So we see that, you know, something it doesn't, so that's financial, that's a forensic accountant. So a spiritual forensic accountant looks at certain behaviors and say, you know, this behavior would indicate I have a certain flaw. Because when we just go through life, we think we're great and amazing. Now, of course, in Judaism, we have to make improvements in life. And part of life is to look at the flaws that our body produces and to fix them. That's part of a good person, and you have to do that whatever, once a week, once a month. You have to sit down at a quiet time and review your life and say, you know what, let me see what I'm all about and let me see what areas need improvement. But, however, you have to also take something else into account, and this is where we change from our forensic accountants. The forensic accountants only want to see what's bad, bring up the mud and destroy the guy and make him pay big fines. But a spiritual forensic accounting also, and no less important, says, what are all the virtues? You are such a responsible person. You are such a loving person. So you know what? Have you figured out ways to expand that love to people who could use your love that you have not considered before? Because you're really good at being a sensitive person. So why should it only be with your family, you know, and you feel that something's missing? You got a lot of extra time. So instead of getting in trouble and fooling around with the secretary, I don't know, because you're getting through a midlife crisis, why don't you try to help people, you know, that you will feel satisfied helping without having to get entangled in ways you shouldn't. So that's by focusing on the positive things that you have. That's a proper accounting would accurately evaluate both the virtues and the faults. So again, that's why I come back to that point again. So if you are told of a fault, you'd be grateful. Wouldn't you be grateful? You're driving on the 401. Someone honks you and says, want you to know, psst, buddy, your tire's low. I have the guts to tell me my tire's low. It's a brand new Lamborghini and he tells me the tires are low. You think the guy's nuts. So what do you want? The guy just wants to make sure your tire doesn't fall off and you don't have any problems over there, right? You wouldn't get upset, right? Somebody would tell you, you know, a few tiles are missing on your roof. I saw from across the street your house. You say, thank you so much. So that's if your life is building up your soul. If you're looking at your life, I'm a soul and I'm building myself up. I'm happy. I'm not threatened by the criticisms. But if all you are is a body and that's all you're focusing on and those negative things, so you know what? Automatically you're taking it extremely personally. So he's saying the improper focus, where does this all come from? Very interesting. Where does this all come from? Any behavior has to be identified in the Torah. So he says, it's amazing. This comes from the sin of first man. It's interesting. God said to him like this. He said, don't eat from that forbidden fruit. I'll read the Hebrew. He says, ki beyom achalcha mimenu, because the day you will eat from that fruit, mos tamus, you will surely die. So the simple meaning is, man was meant to live as an immortal human being. And God says, if you will eat, you will now bring in a sense of mortality into your life, and then you will physically die. That's the simple reading, which is certainly true. So he says an additional interpretation. He says like this. He said, the result of this sin. Now remember, I don't want to get overly, this is a whole big subject here, but the challenge of the first sin was that first man was a soul. When he was originally, he knew he was a soul. He knew it. And he knew the body was only a garment. His soul, the garment, I think we mentioned this before, right, was translucent. His body was not the way you have it now. It was translucent, like a fingernail. And the soul shined right through. You know, it's mistaken. He was a soul. Okay, he just needed something to keep the soul in one place, so the body keeps it in one place. But then, so he had a soul, which was driving and energizing that body and keeping the body intact. But when you are told by God not to engage in a certain physical behavior and you do, then you make the big mistake. And that was the very first mistake, that the man identified himself with his body needs and not with his soul needs. If God tells you not to do something, you know, your soul says, stay away. Well, the body says, it looks so interesting. I'm curious. What could be so good about eating from that fruit? And the snake comes along and says, you know why he told you not to eat from that fruit? Because he ate from that fruit and that made him God. And he doesn't want you to eat it, because if you eat it, you'll be God. And he doesn't want any competition. Curious. And God said, don't eat from it. I'm telling you, I know what's best for you. Just a power play. He's trying to keep control over you. So the body doesn't want to be controlled. So now when you eat from that, that is the moment, what God is saying, you know what the problem is going to be when you're going to eat? You are going to now start to identify yourself as a body now and not as a soul. And when that happens, now, from that day you will surely die. He says like this. He says, once you focus on being the body, then you will look at yourself like a dead man. Ka'adam shlili, like a negative person. Ka'adam shekol chisaron mikarevis kitzo, that every fault is bringing you to the end of your life. Meaning to say, every fault and every criticism that you will hear makes you feel that you don't deserve to be in this world again. When people, you know, are not able to handle criticism, so what happens when they can't handle the criticism? When they feel it's a personal affront? On a certain level, you'd rather die. You'd rather die. And that's what he's saying. When you're going to eat from this, you're going to bring in this concept of not just physical mortality, but this psychological mortality. I mean, people would rather do anything than to hear criticism. And people, you know, I die from that criticism. And you could see that certain people just get all, they want to just, you know, you want to bury your head in the ground. I felt like I would want to die. And that's going to be really careful with teenagers. You know, you get a little too rough on them and they'll commit suicide. They're going to think, I'm terrible, I have no reason to live anymore, and goodbye, sure, that's the end of it. So that's what he's saying. So instead of looking at the reality that you're a living person, that you're building yourself up, because a soul is a growing, promising entity, and then you're going to build up others. Instead, when you hear these criticisms, you think, that's who I am, I must be a lousy guy, and you start spinning down this abyss, you get a distorted view of how you look at yourself, and that's killing you. It's not really the criticisms per se, but it's the false way you look at yourself, and that is the worst death imaginable. That's what God's saying. You're gonna eat from this. You will now identify as a body, and now you will forever, right? This whole idea, you know, with ladies, I don't know if it's still true anymore. It was true when I was younger, right? What's the one thing a lady cannot live through when she goes to a party? Somebody has the same outfit. Is that still around? I don't know if it's. But you know what if everybody thinks you look like a weirdo?
I think if you're the same boyfriend.
Okay, whatever. No, but it's like, you know, like let's think about it. Okay, I really don't mean to stereotype here, but you know, I think it's true. Women do spend a little bit more time than men getting ready to go out. Right?
No.
No?
Oh, no?
Who are you married to?
No, not for my husband, but I see. I see a lot of guys who dress and who take very good care of themselves.
So they're becoming like women. Okay, that's fine. Well, that society is that way. But it used to be, okay, so you tell me now, used to be guys just take 3 minutes and they're ready. All it takes for a guy, put on a suit and you're finished, right? What takes my wife a half hour? I still don't know. So now, as you're saying, the guys are more like the women. They're both spending a half an hour, right? Why? Why? How will I look? If they think I look weird, I'd rather die. Right? You're so worried. I said, my teenage daughters, I say, you're looking for a shidduch already? You're looking to get married? I said, okay, if I understand perspective, whatever. Guys, would be there. Okay, you don't want to look. You want to look your best. But you're just 16. I mean, you know, religious girls, you know, from Beis Yaakov, they don't go out until much later. Says, so what are you worried about? No, I have to look. You know, I said, no, you look fine. You looked fine in the house. I mean, who are you making yourself look pretty for? It was for myself. I said, in the house yourself wasn't okay. Now in front of 300 strangers, and I said, I want to tell you a secret, dear. It's a wedding. Nobody's looking at you. Like, that's a shock. You only realize that when you get older. You know, you think, when you're 20, you think everybody's looking at you. When you're 50, you knew no one ever was looking at you. They never were looking at you, and you thought they were all looking at you. But that whole idea, I'd rather die than be caught looking foolish. That's all a body language, and that's what God said to Adam. When you eat from that food and you identify with the body, you will die 1,000 deaths from your insecurities that you are going to feel. And that's the Torah source for that. Right? So, okay, we can skip a little bit. And let's go all the way now. I'm skipping the not so exciting parts. Let's go to page 55, practical effort. So at the end of this chapter, he's going to give us two exercises that I want everybody to start working on. This is your first homework. Okay? And next I'm going to ask you if you did your homework. If not, I'm going to keep you after class. Okay? To do your homework. Okay? Because this book, you can't just listen and laugh or listen and sleep. You have to do the exercises. This is, you know, and they're not difficult exercises. So let's take a look at what the exercises are. He says, Havod ha-masas binyan zeh, what is the practical work to do? Yichol li-asas v'achas v'shtei afshar. There's two ways. So achas number one, Adam kovei la-asma b'li-neder sh'pamayim b'yom. You should accept upon yourself without making a vow. Very religious man here, but it's make a plan. Twice a day, kishiyasa masasli, when you do something wrong, he's assuming we do something wrong twice a day. Okay? Okay? O yargish hargashis, or you have a negative thought. Let's say somebody tells you something amazing about somebody else, and right away you start feeling jealous. Okay, be honest. People have these feelings, right? No, that person was amazing, and that happens to be your competitor. Okay, and then you start saying, nah, he's not that good. You know, I do better than him. You know, but you didn't say anything, like, it's not, but you know inside, you know, or somebody, like, didn't say good morning to you, and you say, I don't know what's wrong with them. So you really didn't judge them favorably at all. Whatever. So it doesn't mean you did something bad. You just thought something that wasn't good. You had a bad thought. You know, I'm really angry. Whatever it is. So twice a day, when you do that, regardless if you did it towards yourself, it had negative feelings about yourself or towards other people, right? But the fact of the matter is you identified with something negative about yourself. You should repeat to yourself and say the following. Even though the action that I did was wrong, even though the feeling or the thought that I had was a negative feeling, this is only a garment of me. These are impure garments. But the I, the essential I that God created, remains pure and holy. Do that twice a day. Right? So after you yell at your wife or your husband and you go into your corner, you go back and say, okay, what I did was wrong, but it was my body that did this thing. It isn't me. I am still a holy, pure person. Do that twice a day. Okay? Now he's making an assumption. You're going to do something wrong twice a day. If anybody comes and says, you know, last week on when I did two things wrong a day, that already is bad news. That already is the first thing you should fault yourself for. If at the end of this, you know, I didn't do anything wrong today, so already say, I have feelings of arrogance. I am so arrogant that I can't even find two things wrong in the day? That is a very negative thing, and that is not part of who I am. It's just the garment of arrogance that I carry, but I'm really a pure and holy person.
Okay.
I'm sorry? We're not even talking about tshuva now. We're not talking about tshuva now.
But if I say that it's not really me, my soul is
pure. You have to do tshuva for that. You still are responsible for what your body does. You know, the Talmud tells us if you own an ox, and you were negligent with your ox, you didn't lock it in the garage, right? As you went to the class, you've got to lock the garage, and your ox goes and now tramples over your neighbor's rose bush. Do you have to pay or not? Of course you do. It's your responsibility to watch your ox. So when the ox inside of you gores another person with a slinging comment, even though that's not you, it's the ox in you, you're still responsible to pay. You're still responsible to deal with that. So there's, of course, a concept of tshuva, but you have to look at it as it's your ox. The ox that's really chained to you. That's the garment. So now twice a day say, it's not me. I'm responsible for it. I'm not blowing off responsibility, but I am a pure and holy neshama. That is what you're giving yourself, healthy criticism. Get used to enjoy healthy criticism. Okay? And if you can do it to yourself in a positive way, you'll see after a while, you know what? You won't feel so threatened to talk about these things. It's like a remarkable thing. And then when other people will start criticizing you, you will hear it that way. They're not telling me I'm bad. They're telling me that my sweater is dirty. Thank you so much. I give you a hug and a kiss. for trying to point out that my sweater needs to be fixed up. So you think this is a silly exercise. This is not a silly exercise. Because we all have very bruised egos, as much as we want to admit it or not. We have bruised sensitivities. So start working on yourself. You know you like yourself still. So get used to hearing a criticism from yourself, but a perfectly worded criticism. It's my garment is dirty, but I am a beautiful soul. That's number one. Yes, ma'am. Just say, well, I guess he's insulting my garment. So let me think. Is the person saying anything that makes any sense? If he does, I'm very fortunate he pointed it out to me. Like, that's such a healthy way to live. Thank you so much for the criticism. You know, it's Rav Moshe Feinstein, the great rabbi who passed away about 25 years ago. You know, he was a tzaddik. He's an unbelievable tzaddik. And there was a certain period of time where some people, I don't know why, they decided just gang up on the poor rabbi. I mean, he was like the greatest rabbi who lived in North America. And people had, you know, issues. You know, he stuck to his guns to certain halachic decisions, and they'd call him up and let him have it on the phone. And he'd listen patiently. He'd say, a groisa dank. Thank you so much for telling me this. I'll think about it. I'll see what I should do. Thank you so much for calling. It didn't bother him, accuser. Because he didn't feel threatened by it, because he knew what they were dealing with. Okay, second one is Ofen Shady Shalavoda, Lo Biyachas L'Masivol, not related to any specific activities, but rather a person should set up every day a certain small amount of time, 5 minutes, 2 minutes. Now you all have 2 minutes during the day that are free, right? 2 minutes a day, and repeat over this thing, and just say, who am I? Who am I? I am a holy reality, a pure reality that was created by Hashem. There is no blemishes in my soul. There isn't even a scratch on it. And any negative things that I may recognize in myself, even if they are many, they are just garments on top of my pure and holy soul. And just say that for 2 minutes. That's your mantra. For 2 minutes a day, just say, I have a pure and holy soul that God gave me. It's perfect. There's nothing wrong with it. The fact that I scream and yell and overeat and all these other things, I've got a very dirty garment that needs to get cleaned. That's all. It's the same thing as the other one. Just one is in response to something you've done wrong, and the other one is just a general comment to yourself of who you are. To do those exercises really 3 times a day. Twice after doing something wrong, and 1 time after, what, at any time, just to say that mantra to yourself. This tzaddik is a very big believer. It's not him, it's from the Torah. The more you verbalize things, the more they become real. And the greatest truths in our lives, we fail to say them. And we all know this is a truism. You all know it's true. All of you who are married or have friends, right? What do you want that person to say to you? I love you. That's it. It doesn't have to be so innovative. It just has to be heartfelt. You never tire from hearing that, do you? And of course, the dumb husband says, of course I love her. I don't have to tell her, you idiot you. You have to tell her. Because the fact you don't tell her really means you probably don't. Because the more you say things, the more you believe it. The less you say, the less you believe it. And that's the realities. You love your kids, tell it to them. Well, they know it. No. Say it. The more you say it, the more real. Certainly you have a holy soul. How do you even know you have a... You got to talk about it. The more you talk about it, the more real it is. Okay, that is the end of chapter 3. Now we're going to jump into chapter 4. Okay, is everybody okay? Is it fine? Good? Not okay. Okay, Ben, go ahead. What are you not okay with?
Why are you accepting these two tests as a panacea or a cure?
It's not a cure. It's the first step.
Why are you accepting them as a first step? what makes them correct.
Because it's right. It's based on the truisms that we've talked about for the last 6 weeks. We've already spent 6 weeks discussing that you are a soul and not a body. And the more accurate description is you are a soul. Recognize your soul will take you out of any depression you're in. You're able to handle criticisms because it's only the garment that people are discussing. The faults come from the body. The good comes from the soul. So we're just reinforcing everything we've been discussing for the last 6 weeks.
I don't see how those two tests relate to your prior discussion. Walking around saying, I'm a holy soul, doesn't sound like a cure.
It is the beginning of the cure. What is the issue here? The issue is, the most important issue is, what do you identify with? That's what we discussed. Do you identify yourself as a soul, or do you identify yourself as a body? Right? And we've already proved we really are souls. What will make you a happier person, a better sense of self-esteem, if you recognize you're a soul? These are the realities. These aren't, if you like it or not, that's what you are. If you don't recognize it and you identify yourself as a body, you're doomed to have an unhappy life. So now all we're saying is, so let's bring out those statements of fact. The more you talk about something, the more real it becomes. You bring it up to your level of consciousness. You got, that's a principle in any type of behavior development, especially when you're talking about bringing out a soul. The way a soul works, and in the other books he talks a lot about this, the soul gets aroused by the voice. The voice brings out the soul. So it can't bring out, if you're saying you're a soul, you gotta say it. It's not just good enough to think it. And it brings it to your conscious level. The more you're consciously aware of it, the more that reality becomes one that you are in tune with. This is a principle of behavior. It's a behavior principle as it relates to the soul. I don't have time now. I can reference you to where in the second book of Bilvavi, which you can purchase in the English version, where he spends the first two chapters going at length to describe exactly that point. And so there's an assumption I'm making. It's not an assumption. He's proved through many sources that verbalization is key to bringing out the soul. Okay, so you'll just have to accept it. You'll accept it. But it works. Try it for a few weeks. This isn't going to be the panacea. This is just step one. Got to bring it to your conscious level. Keep saying, I am a soul. The mistakes are the bodies. It's not going to hurt my self-esteem. And that you keep talking about it. You will be have a healthy way to deal with it. Okay? Good. So now we're going to start a new topic in chapter 4. Now we're down to 10 minutes, but that's okay. We've got next week. We always have another week. That's always good. So he talks about a principle now at the bottom of page 56. He calls it Koach HaLevad, the power of being alone. The power of alone. And this is going to be a tool he's going to talk about for many chapters. So in 10 minutes, you're not going to get the full flavor of this. We're just going to start it. We're going to really work on it next week, and then he's going to give us exercises again. Now, you're going to say, this sounds like meditation. Guess what? We invented it. You don't have to go to India. The real thing is here, right in our own religion, has the healthy way of Jewish meditation. It's really what this chapter is leading us into. All right. So and remember, this tzaddik, he doesn't know of any psychology books. He only knows Torah, he said. So therefore, what he's saying is pure Torah. So he's saying that there are people in the world, there exists in people a world of feelings. Each of us have many, many feelings that a lot of people may not know about our feelings. We may not even know about our feelings. There are some people who are more emotional. There are some people who are less emotional. But he says, we want to be able to dissect our feelings. Now, this is very powerful because what you feel is what you identify with. Right? He says, if we try to show how we work with our feelings and how we contend with our feelings, how we associate the positive feelings as the I, and to understand they're part of the neshama, and how we have to start to identify the negative feelings and separate them, and to so that these are feelings that aren't me, We talked last about actions. Now we're talking about feelings, which is really the thing that's going to be the root of all our actions, which is a little harder world over here. So we have to know which emotions, for example, we should be embracing, which emotions are really coming from my neshama, and I should act on those emotions, and which emotions we should reject as an emotion that should not be dealt with in this way, but rather in another way, in a more positive way. You know, that's really a lot of what poetry is all about. Poetry is people expressing their emotions. It has now turned, and a lot of those emotions really are just coming from the body, not from the soul. King David's poetry came from the soul, but a lot of people's really comes from the body, and usually, and now a lot of the lyrics are just turned into music. And you know, you could have musicians who sing real powerful love songs to their wives. You know, you may remember, I remember, you know, in the 60s, I Got You, Babe. You know, oh, it was such a nice couple. So romantic. There's such a, you know, I must have been, I don't know, 8, 9 years old. I had nothing to do as a kid. It's terrible. So they put me in front of the TV and I just watched, right? I Got You, Babe. You know, and you know, oh, it's like such nachas, you know, and then they got the little child, you know, chastity in the face, and it's like mamish, and those words, like, if you remember the niggin, then, you know, Baruch Hashem, I almost forgot it, you know, but you know, you got this problem, that problem, but I got you, babe, you know, wow, they must have the best marriage, you know, but that's all body talk. And what happens? The most brutal divorce you ever saw years later. Right? So, you know, so that all came from the body. And later, it didn't come from the neshama at all. Right? So you gotta be careful with those feelings. Are they real feelings? They're not real feelings. And he says, and in general, our feelings are divided into two categories. There are feelings that we have towards other people in social contexts. And there's feelings about the person asks for himself. What do you think about yourself? We have feelings towards others of love and respect or anger, jealousy, whatever we can recognize. And he says many times there are negative feelings that we have towards other people that can really destroy lives. And it comes from negative feelings. And what he's going to teach in this book is how to cope with these feelings. What he's going to do in the next two chapters is going to say, how can you get yourself out of that world of anger? Frustration with other people and you find difficult to live with. And he's going to show us through these strategies that we're talking about how you can leave that false world and get into a truer world that will remove you from these issues. He says, for example, give an example, you have conflict with other people. Okay? Think of the last time you had a serious conflict with somebody. Serious. Okay, I'm not talking about, you know, the delivery boy, you know, not delivering the pizza on time, you know. This may be a little extreme, but your whole goal in life is to destroy the other person. Till you ruin them, till they collapse. That person's presence in his life should collapse. I wish he was dead. I wish he was, what's the word I'm looking for? Like disempowered. And I can just emasculate the person. You know? That they'll never have the chutzpah to do that again to me. Right? And it's happening a lot nowadays. And you don't forgive about the past. And more than this, you start investing money. You start investing time and efforts. And the main thing is that other person should pay for what they've done. And you're willing to take off time from work, and you're willing to hire expensive lawyers for thousands of dollars. But the main thing is to get the other side to suffer. So there is, I mean, we know that that exists because lawyers are doing pretty well in the divorce courts lately, right? So there must, and they're playing on this feeling here. Their mom is taking it to the bank. They're laughing all the way to the bank, the lawyers, both lawyers. They probably call us and say, "Huh? Should we get them? Should we get the couple to fight again? We'll make another $20,000. Well, you make a stay, a motion, and I'll stay the motion, and we'll go back and forth." you know, I shouldn't be thinking so negatively about lawyers, but, you know, I can't imagine why two lawyers wouldn't do that. Because they're playing on these people's emotions. Oh, I wouldn't let him get away with that. Oh, no, we can make a motion. You know, so people do that, and there's so much suffering goes on, and so much effort of anger is so strong that the person can't free himself from it. Do you ever have these times where you're so angry, you're so into it, you can't even get away from it, you can't even forget about it, it just totally is consuming you. Right, so there's so many of these examples that refer to us when we're dealing with other people. So now he says, these are the kind of things he wants to help us with. Okay, so he starts off, we'll start with this first, where is this all coming from, what we're trying to accomplish. So he said, when first man was created, how was he created? How many first men did he make? One. Even with the Midrashim, it was one. It was one being. Then he made the Azer Kenegdo. Then he made the helpmate against him, the spouse. And then there were the kids, Cain and Abel. But the original structure of the first human being was not a structure of two, it was a structure of one that was alone. Why did God do that? Why couldn't he create two people to begin with? So he's saying there's a very important point over here, is to show us there are two equally important powers within, forces within the human being that must both be equally used. One is called the power of, we'll call it a sociological power, where to thrive, to be with other people. And there's a tremendous power. People need people, as the song goes. And that's a very healthy thing and a very positive thing. And when he found Chava, he said, wow, bone from my bone, flesh from flesh. This is what I've been looking for. And that's a wonderful thing to have. But it can't be in a vacuum. But there is a prior power and force that's deeper than that in the person. And that's the inner force of the person himself. This solitude person of solitude. Because the original man was first a solitude man, where there was nobody else. And that's why God created man alone first, so that mankind would always be able to tap into this power of being alone. Because this power will really help a person be the real you, who will really be able to love other people. We talked about this in the first class. In order to recognize, you know, and loving other people, you have to recognize who the real I is. And this is where we talk about this havdalah, the separation. How are you able to separate your feelings? What's a real feeling and what's not a real feeling? What's a feeling that defines who you are? It's a soulful feeling. And what's a feeling that doesn't define who you are? You cannot do it unless you are alone with yourself. And what the author is going to teach us, it's much harder than you think to be alone. We're not talking about lonely. We're talking about the aloneness of solitude. Where, and this is not an easy thing, to be able to think about who you are. Not who what society says you are. Not to think about other people. Try, if you've done these exercises already, if you think you need, just try to be alone with yourself for 2 minutes and just think about you, and you'll see it's almost impossible. You will find that most things you think about invariably will be about a lot of other people as well. You'll see. And this is something he's going to train us how to, because if you can't think of who you are, then you don't know who you are. You cannot. The prerequisite to being a healthy social being is a healthy solitude being. And that's the way man was created first. So you've got to be able to create a part of you that is the solitude, alone part of you. That not just being alone, you know, and watching TV. That's not being alone. That's with the whole Hollywood in your house. But to be alone. And then what you're feeling, and make sure those feelings are your feelings and not other people's feelings, will be the first time for many of us that we really found out who we are. And only when you know who you are, then the following words will really have any meaning. When you say to someone, I love you. because most of us don't know who the I is. And that's what we're going to get into next week a lot. That's going to be the whole class for the next few weeks. How do I find the I? And why that's so important in terms of any other relationship I have, and where that becomes the so to speak, refuge. That when I'm in the middle of a rip-roaring fight, how do I get out of it? It all depends on who you develop that inner I that comes with solitude. So that's going to be next week's discussion. Please work on your homework this week. Next week, 7:30. We have to do 7:30. I'm sorry it's hard. Anybody wants to buy a book, their books, where did I leave them? In the back? It's $30. That's what it costs us to get them here. And you can catch up, and we're up to approximately page 59 or so. Have a wonderful day.
Yeah. By the way, Chastity, who decided was safe.